What was it like then? Was it surreal?
It was pouring with rain.
Was it?
Yes.
Welcome home.
It was pouring with rain, but it was real. I had a very, because my legs were beginning to show signs of weakness again, I was lifted up through the bomb bay into the blister on the back of the bomber where the wireless operator was. And they were Australians. It's an Australian crew. And the wireless operator, I said, when we took off, I said, where were we heading for? He said, just Blighty. I said, oh, we're going to... No. He said, I can't tell you where we're going. So I said, what, why? He said, well, there are some mad brain Luftwaffe pilots about who won't believe the war has ended. And they'll just like you to have a go at us. That's why these Spitfires are flying above us. He said, we've got to cover Spitfires.
Mm.
So we're escorted across Germany. And at one stage, I looked down out of my blister down below. I said to this wireless operator, I know where we are now. Oh, do you? Yeah. I said, that's Cologne Cathedral. Down there on the Rhine. Look, you can see the river. There's the cathedral. And he got on the radio to the pilot and he said, do you want a rest? Why? He said, well, there's a geezer in here. He said he could take over the plane. He knows where we are. Yeah. So as we left Cologne, we went and we went on to, over the channel. I said, well, that's Deal down there. And as we came around, I said, well, there's Margate, Ramsgate and Margate. Oh, I said, Southend Pier. He said, we're supposed to be secret. But we eventually went right round North London and we went over Runnymede. I said to this chap, I said, tell her, ask the pilot if he can put down on the field down there, could I get a bus home for me? So he laughed about that. He said, what, here? I said, yes, that's Runnymede down there. And I said, the Thames goes through Staines. I said, I live over there. So we went to Oxford and to a little landing ground just outside Oxford. And we landed there in pouring rain. I said to the boys, eight of those boys, of the 45, they came, I got them home. They came with me. And I said to them, we are well and truly in England, boys. It's pouring with rain. And we were met at the plane by eight WAF girls, RAF girls, with lorries, and they took us over to a hangar where we had bread and cheese sandwiches about that thick, and pickles, and mugs of tea.
What was you like? What did you look like compared to the soldiers that weren't captured, the non-POWs?
Well, we looked a bit ragged, a bit thin. But although it was hot weather when we arrived, it was May. It was hot weather. We had to put heavy pullovers on, army. We had army clothes available, and we put sometimes two pullovers on to keep warm. But we went to a little camp out in Chalfont, St. Giles, And we got cleaned up. We had every wonderful organisation. We had a medical, teeth, haircuts and balls and feet looked at, and everything was checked medically and everything. And we saw the paymaster, who got money, ration cards, everything we needed, new uniforms, even so far as the medal ribbons was put on.
Oh, really?
All that. And we were there three or four days, and the morning came when we were taken by lorry to Beaconsfield station and put on a train for London.
You went to Leconsfield?
Beaconsfield.
Oh, Beaconsfield.
Beaconsfield. We went, and there was a train there for us. And we went into Marylebone Station, and when we got there, the other trains had come in with prisoners of war on, and the post office had lined up lots of post office vans with seats in for this purpose.
Mm.
And we were taken to our termini. Now, I went in one for Waterloo. And that one there was for Fenchurch Street. That one was for Walthamstow or somewhere. And London Bridge. I went to Waterloo. And with one of my pals. And when we got to Waterloo Station, we were amazed. As we got out of the... We were lifted out. And we had a kit bag with us. Each one had a kit bag with some clutter in it. And a company of Grenadier Guards there. And they... each one of us had someone to carry our kit bag.
Mm.
A guardsman. And they took us to the indicator board to get our station. I said to mine, I said, station, platform number one for me, Shepparton. Do you know? I said, yes, I know. There go there. And we went down there, and there it was, Shepparton.
Was it? What was it like getting back home? Was the family there when you got there?
Yeah, my girlfriend she hadn't seen me for 4 years.
You still had a girlfriend?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. She did a lot for my family while I was a prisoner with the Red Cross and with the army.
Did they know if you were still alive?
She dedicated herself to looking after my affairs. She couldn't wait until I got home. Oh yeah, we got married. We got it. We didn't get married that year. We got engaged soon after I got home, and then we went to. We waited a year. I said I'll wait until I put on some flesh, and make sure I'm not ill.
Yeah,
got a lot of TB about for people like us, and. Oh, yeah, she was waiting. I got on a train at Waterloo and I went, I looked out all the way down the line to Sunbury. And when I got to Sunbury Station, there, she was there. And we'd sent telegrams. In that camp, telegrams to our families had already been made out. All we had to do was put the address on and sign it. And it just said simply, I have arrived safely in England and will be with you in 2 or 3 days.
Had there been no contact then throughout the time you was a prisoner of war?
Oh, yes, she'd written...
Oh, so you could still get letters through?
Oh, yes.
The Red Cross?
Yeah, yeah, the Red Cross letters.
Right.
They used to take about 3 or 4 months to get to you. So
if... We complain now if our email
is
down.
I know. but you see, if she wrote and told me that old Mrs. Hedges up the road had died, you remember her? Yeah, but when I got it, she'd been dead and buried
for 3 months.
Yeah, and things like that. And there was a funny episode in the camp, in Dresden. We were not allowed to have photographs from home. That was forbidden. If anyone sent you a photograph, it went to a special place in Berlin somewhere, and they were afraid that between the photograph itself and its backing, there might be a message code. Mm. So that was streng verboten, strongly forbidden. Now, my girlfriend was able in England at that time, when there were no films about any, you couldn't buy a film, but she was able to get a photograph because her father worked in a government laboratory where they did a lot of photographs. And so she bought some stuff, mixed up some developing stuff, and they managed to get a photograph. And she, my girlfriend used to go under the stairs and develop these photographs. They used they had a plate camera at home. And she photographed my cousin I was brought up with, who had a baby. And the little baby was about 3 or 4 months old. And my father-in-law-to-be, he took, with their old plate camera, he took a photograph of my cousin and her baby. And my wife printed this. Oh, my girlfriend, she printed it. And she sent it in a letter to me. And it arrived in a camp in Dresden, and the commandant got hold of it. And he had it on his desk, and he sent for me. And I could see it was a photograph of something. He had his hand on this thing. And I said to, "You called for me, Commandant." "Yes," he said, "I've got something here which is addressed to you, but you're not allowed to have it." I said, "Oh, is it a letter?" "No," he said, "it is a photograph." He said, "It's under my hand." He said, "You know it's against the rules for British people to send photographs." I said, "Yes, but I have no control over that. I can't." "That's true," he said. "So this is going into the waste bin." I said, "Well, thank you for telling me." He said, "Does it worry you that you can't have that photograph?" I said, "No, I didn't know it was coming. Presumably I've got a letter that will tell me that the photograph has been sent." He said, "That's as may be." And he looked at the photograph. This is where he slipped up. He said, "It's a nice photograph." He said, "It is a photograph of your wife and your baby. I played along with it. I said, oh, and I can't see it. No. He said, I'm going to give it to you. Put it in your locker in the brick works. And if there's an inspection of lockers by the German army, make sure that's not seen. He said, can you cover it with something? I said, yes. He said, I'm not supposed to talk to you like this, but he said, I have got a son and he is badly wounded in Italy in the German army. And if his wife and baby appeared to him on a photograph, I would hope, if he's a prisoner of war, that the British would have let him have it. So he said, you can have this.
Hmm.
It wasn't my wife and baby at all.
The sentiments
there. I wasn't even married.
Yeah, the sentiments there, though, isn't it? And there's that compassion that was shown.
Well, they didn't know who it was. It was he who said it was my wife and baby. Hmm.
It almost sounded like it was to make him feel better about
his
son.
He was trying to be clever.
What do you think? I think he was there. It sounds very much like he was trying to look after himself. And by doing that act to you, he was being very compassionate to his son as well.
Son, yeah. Oh, yes.
What was your opinions of the Germans and the Italians in the years after the war?
Well, I went to Germany after the war and I was treated very well by the Germans. And we linked up with the German family and we're still linked up with them.
Mm.
And we're about the fourth generation now,
really?
Of them. And a complete friendship. Now... That was the Germans. I've been over to Germany. My daughter goes over frequently and the Germans come over here for holidays and various family things. That same family. But the Italian side of it was rather strange because you see an Italian army officer got me walking again.
Mm.
Now, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, two or three years ago, a family in Sunbury I know, the son goes to Italy on holidays and he is engaged to an Italian nurse at a hospital in Milan. And I happened to be talking to them one day at home, and I told them about Dr. Alessi and my legs. And he told his fiancée, who's an Italian nurse in Milan, about my legs.
Mm.
And she went to a shop. She went somewhere in Milan and she contacted the family of that doctor in a shop. And they gave her a box of chocolates from a factory in that town in Milan for me. And I had the chocolate at home with the family. Now, she said that she had found the family of that doctor. And it was in Rome. And the family phoned me up. A lady phoned me up one day, and in English, I could tell she was Spanish or Italian by her dialect, but she spoke English. And she said, "I am the daughter of Dr. Antonino Alessi, who performed operations on your legs in Bologna during the Second World War. And my father is now dead, but I've got two sisters and a brother. We're all medicos. My brother actually is a vet. We would like you to come to Italy and have a holiday with us so that we can find out all about our father, what he did for you. Think about it and let us know. My telephone number is in Rome is this, gave me. But I said to her, I don't think I'll be able to make it because I'm close on 100 years old. And also my legs that your father saved, my legs are beginning to feel that trouble coming back. I can't walk very far. So she rang me back a little while later and she said, "I do appreciate what you've said. I'm making arrangements with the Italian embassy in London for me to come to England and to stay in a hotel and for them to send a car down to you where you live on the River Thames and take you up and so we can have lunch at the embassy together and hear all about my father." Well, that wasn't long ago. And I've not heard about this car coming yet.
Oh, really?
So it probably never happened.
Yeah.
But wasn't it strange?
Yeah, amazing.
He said, "My father has died."
Mm.
He died in 1994. And he said, "My brother has just retired. He's the vet. He's 74. So I reckon that she would be about 68 or something.
Well, let us know. Like, keep let us know if that.
Yeah.
That, but what's that happens, strange? Be fascinating. Yeah. What's because you saw the early part of the war, you know, especially around, you know, it'd be Dunkirk, and then the war in Northern Africa.
Yeah.
And then, of course, spending the years you did in as a POW. What did you learn from it? What did you learn from all this, if anything?
Well, I had to renew my life. I had to rebuild my life. And you see, I'd been a clerk in a building outfit. But I could have gone back there. But I thought more seriously about it. And I decided that I'd like to work in local government or in central government in some way. So I got in touch with the army education people and I said, "I'm willing to take a course. Can you help me in any way?" And I said, "I'd like to take a course which would permit me to go into the examination room for the civil service." I mean, you had to have six O levels to to get into the examination room. So the army reply was, "We will help you." And they got all the books and papers, and I did a correspondence course to get my O levels, and the army paid for it. I only had to pay my fare to go to one or two meetings, lectures, but I passed with an A1 pass to get into the civil service.
Mm.
So I've been a civil servant. I was a civil servant for 40 years.
Mm.
And
you really progressed afterwards. Did you take life? Did you grab hold of life more? Do you feel like you love life? What's the more emotional side of it? Because you saw some horrors. You know whether that's Dresden, whether that is starvation.
No, that didn't rebound on me at all. What rebounded on me about the year after I came home was building up my body again, and I was quite ill for a while.
Mm.
But the civil service, I'd already got a place, and the sick conditions, sick leave conditions in the civil service were pretty good, and are pretty good. I was allowed to have some shortened hours work so I could build myself up again. But mentally and emotionally, well, we were a young married couple. It was heaven on earth, you see. And eventually we had a daughter, and an absolute joy to us. And my wife is now no longer with us, but my daughter is, and her daughters. So I got a family, and they look after me very well.
Mm.
You see, so it was quite it was very rewarding.
Yeah.
But I didn't go mad. I didn't go on the drink or anything. I never smoke. So I'm very careful about food. And I only have plain food, very plain. If I go out for dinner with a party of people, invariably I've got to very choosy for what I eat. Because the plainer, the better, the food. If I have anything too rich, it does rebound a bit.
Mm.
And I suppose, really, the rubbish I ate as a prisoner of war has injured my stomach in some way.
Mm.
But so I've got to play up with my old friend in here. Make sure. But I live a happy-go-lucky.
Yeah.
And nothing seems to get me down. I swore, when one of my friends I came home with, he lived at Bournemouth, down there. And when I last saw him, and that was just after we got home, he came to my house in Sunbury. And I said to him at the time, I said, "George, I remember talking to you in the desert when we were prisoners and amongst all those wounded chaps. I said, I made up my mind and I told you, nothing now is ever going to get me down. Life cannot be any worse than it is now."
Mm.
At that time, I said, "It's too bad, but nothing's going to get me down, ever." And he said, well, that's a good policy if you can stick to it. He said, I don't think I can stick to it. I said, well, I'm going to. And I have. I said, nothing can be worse than what we're going through at the moment that's out there. He agreed. He did say that was a possibility. But I didn't dwell on it too much after that.
Just live life.
And eventually he died. But that's my policy. Happy-go-lucky. And it's only... my feet are a bit troublesome now. I'm walking. And I had bronchitis about 4 or 5 years ago, and I lost my voice. And that hasn't come back properly. That's why it's a rather grating voice. And I used to be a fairly good tenor in the choir singing, but I can't sing anymore. They'd shoot me because I'm on the stage. But there you are.
Yeah.
So that's a rough outline of my life.
Well, you know what? It's been a real pleasure starting with you today. And
what will you do? Edit it that in some way?
I'm not going to edit. We'll just put this out. And I mean, it's fascinating. I think you've...
How's that?
I don't know if we've gone into that. You know, how can we go over 3 years of being a POW? You know, it's a... What a crazy existence that life must have been for that period of time. But Lord, I thank you so much, and we will leave it there.